conjecture we believe in. And I was about to state a recent theorem which goes into this direction, which is the following theorem of Kuchowski. Last year. So Kuchowski studied this question and he came up with a very with an interesting answer, which is not yet the full answer, but still says something in this direction. So if A is a K approximant group, then one can find a sequence Bn containing Bn minus 1 and B1 goes in A, which exhibits some sort of nilpotent behavior. So these sets are, each of them is of size at least some constant depending on K times the size of A. And Bi squared is contained to Bi minus 1. And also the brackets, so B1 bracket with Bi is contained to Bi. So it's not exactly nilpotent, but you see in particular a consequence of this is that A has a large subset. B1, which is stable under commutation, which is invariant. So it contains its set of commutators. So that's already an interesting consequence. So it suggests that we are going towards a nilpotent behavior. So the proof used logic and model theory. So we haven't come up yet with a complete understanding, combinatorial understanding of this proof. Okay. So in the same paper, Kuchowski came up with another. N will depend on K. But the thing is here you don't assume anything. So you don't assume the group is arbitrary. That's power. You can say something about arbitrary group. So it's using the solution of the Hilbert-Schultz problem. It's using Gleason, Yamabe theory, Montgomery Zipin's book. So that's the only thing we know so far about arbitrary. So we believe that maybe an answer to the Hilbert Binet-Strauss conjecture should follow from similar considerations, probably by working out the detailed proof of the Hilbert-Schultz problem. You see, Gromov's theorem also uses, the proof of Gromov's theorem uses the Hilbert-Schultz problem, and in some vague sense, this classification of approximant groups is a kind of generalization of Gromov's theorem.
Sorry, I don't understand the theorem you just wrote on the board.
Yeah.
What about B1? I mean, you say that there exists Bn up to B1,
yes.
And then what? The conclusion is that B1, in fact, was large n contains its commutator.
Yes. So in fact, you have a stronger conclusion. Bi times Bj is contained into Bi plus j minus 1. So this is the conclusion to the question. And then the test.
Okay, so the theorem says that you have this ascending sequence of the set.
Yeah.
And the conclusion says that B1, in fact, is large.
No. This is the conclusion. This is just in particular.
Okay.
In particular.
All right.
In particular, you have this. Okay. Sorry. Yes. I'm sorry.
Okay. Now I understand.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. That's.
So how do you obtain locally compact groups from that setting? So you look at the group generated by K?
So basically the idea is to use logic. So if you sustain by contradiction, so if you take a sequence on counterexamples, you want to build a limiting object which will have nice properties, in particular will be locally compact, and then you can apply this problem. But okay, that's very vague. But the proof is quite involved and uses language and methods of model theory. Okay, so I have to admit that I don't fully understand. So let me now come back to linear groups. I hope I understand better. So for linear groups, historically the first theorem that was very influential in this subject is the theorem of Hilbert. About 5 years ago. And so Helfgott classified the approximate subgroups of a particular class of linear groups. So he was looking at SL2 Zima P, where P is arbitrary. Okay. And he showed that if A is a subset of SL2 Zima PZ, that's a generating subset. Then, if you look at A times A times A, then this is always at least either the size of the group itself, because it may be already the whole group, or it is strictly bigger than one, the size of A to the power 1 plus epsilon, and this epsilon is absolute constant. Epsilon here is absolute constant, strictly positive. Okay, so the proof of Helfgott's theorem was relying crucially on the sum product. So, and last year in the same paper, Kuchowski generalized Helfgott's theorem to an arbitrary algebraic group, so simple algebraic group. So, he showed the following theorem. That if G is a simple algebraic group over field, an algebraically closed field, then for every k, there exists some constant c of k such that the following holds. If you take a set A in G of k, set, then 3 possibilities. So So either the set itself is rather small, so it's less than CFK, or the set itself is in fact contained in a proper subgroup of GFK, a proper algebraic set. So A is contained in a H of K, where H is a proper algebraic subgroup. So one has to be careful here because if you take a finite set, then you know every finite group is an algebraic group. So there are, you know, if K, for instance, is FP bar, the algebraic closure of FP, then there are many finite subgroups. So it's not enough to say H, that it's contained in H of K, because, as I said, every finite group is an algebraic group. So one has to introduce a notion of complexity of algebraic subgroups and complexity of algebraic varieties. So an algebraic variety of bounded complexity, in particular, will have boundedly many irreducible components. So in particular, a finite group with bounded, finite algebraic group with bounded complexity will have only boundedly many elements. So here you have to say proper algebraic subgroup of complexity at most. So I'm going to denote the complexity chi of H, bounded by some constants depending only on G, so on the dimension of G. Okay, so the complexity of an algebraic variety is basically, so there is no very well-defined notion of complexity, but there are various possible definitions. There is no definition that is better than another, but it's basically it's clear what we mean by complexity. It's, you have you have for instance G here as an affine variety, so a subvariety is going to be defined by equations, and you're going to say that subvariety has bounded complexity if the degree of the polynomials defining that variety are bounded.
What do you assume of A?
Of the finite set. Okay. Or, didn't finish. Or, A times A times A is bigger than mean of the group it generates over C of K, or K times A. So you see, this is exactly like Hilbert's theorem. So, so either A is bounded, so we don't say anything here, or it's contained in a proper subgroup. So here, this is taken care of by the assumption generating over there. Or you are in this situation where A times A times A, so either is bigger than K times A, or is already almost all of the group generated by A. Okay, so here, the point is that the C of K depends only on K, and you can choose A arbitrarily. So this theorem can be reformulated by saying that there are no non-trivial approximate subgroups of simple algebraic groups. So I would say no non-trivial, to be more precise, no non-trivial sufficiently Zariski dense. Because of course you can always take an abelian subgroup of G of K and take inside an arbitrary, and that's an approximate group. So That's why I add sufficiently the residence. So sufficiently the residence is this condition, that you're not contained in a proper algebraic subgroup of bounded complexity. Where the complexity is the bound of the complexity you need depends only on G. Understand Kutovsky's paper, at least this part of the paper, together with Ben Green and Terry Tan. And we found a different proof of that theorem, which also gave a better bound, so a bound on C of K. So you see the point here is that if you know that C of K is small, is not too big in terms of K, then you have a stronger theorem. But the problem with Khrushchevsky's proof was that it was completely completely non-effective by principle. It starts starting with taking a sequence of counterexamples and using logic and so on. So they're highly non-effective, let's say. So we came up with a different proof, which, well, in a sense, is not that different, but at least it's very much inspired from the reading of the proof of Khrushchevsky's theorem, but it contains at some points different arguments, and in particular, it makes use of the basic yoga of the approximate proof that I described in the last lecture. So this is here we obtain it. So this theorem we obtain with Ben Green and Jerry Tao. And it turned out that when we announced this result, two other people announced it exactly the same time. And basically, it's actually the same result. And this is a Lassie paper. And a Sabah. So let me state the result. Well, the result is that we have Khrushchevsky's theorem. One can take C of K equals K to the C, where C is some constant depending only on the dimension of G in Khrushchevsky's theorem. So the reason we care about getting the right constant is because for the applications of the applications to group theory and to expanded graphs, you really so this dependence is crucial. So this dependence here is connected to the epsilon you find here. So corollary of this. So maybe let me reformulate. So now the reformulation of this is that every k approximate, every sufficiently Zariski dense k approximate subgroup of G of K. Okay, K is an arbitrary little k is an arbitrary algebraically closed field. K to the C of D controlled by the group it generates, by the finite group it generates.
So a corollary of this, or another way to reformulate it, say something about finite simple groups of Lie type. So there exists epsilon depending only on B, such that if G is a finite simple group of Lie type and rank or dimension at most D, then for every generating set, A, we have that A times A times A is bigger than the mean, the size of G, and A to the power 1 is epsilon. Okay, so in this form, this is really the generalization of Hilbert's theorem. It's very, looks the same. Okay, so a finite simple group of Lie type, you know, they involved several classes. So the basic classes are of the form G of F2, where G is one of those groups, a simple algebraic group over a finite field F2. But you have different forms, so you have the split form and the non-split forms. And then you have, so for both split and non-split forms, it's a direct consequence of the theorem, because they are sufficiently Zariski dense in the algebraic group G by definition somehow. And but you have two other families of finite simple groups of Lie type, which are the Suzuki groups and the Rie groups. So the Suzuki groups, the three other families, Suzuki group and the Rie groups. So there are two families of Rie groups and there is one family of Suzuki groups. So these are groups built out of simple algebraic groups, but they are seen as fixed points of a certain automorphism of the G of FQ, or the split form that you find. So so they are not exactly per se algebraic, so they are not rational points of an algebraic group over FQ. But they are a subgroup of it. And the fact that they are a subgroup of it somehow allows you to use the same methods as for algebraic groups over an algebraic, so as for algebraic groups. And but what you have to show is that they are sufficiently Zariski dense. And this is not entirely obvious, but we checked it for the Suzuki groups and by hand, and for the Rie groups, checking it by hand is a bit harder, but you somehow you can use another deep theorem of Puchovsky, which is called the twisted Lang veil estimate, to check this. Okay. So people on Sabo claim you did it, so maybe. Okay. So that's why I say here for every finite simple group of Lie type, but these two families are a bit problematic. For in our proof. So it seems that the proof by Piper and Sabo takes care of these two groups, maybe in a different way, but we are not absolutely sure.
And what about the alternating groups?
That's a very good point. Yes, so we don't know. Okay, so that's the next open question. classify approximate subgroups. Of AN. Okay, so we don't know what to do here. We know one thing. So this has been. We know one thing. We know that it's going to be slightly more complicated. So I'll give you an example. I'll give you Pieper's example. Pieper's example is it for AN. So it's an example of generating approximate group. Approximate subgroup of AN, which is not small and not everything, which is not non-trivial in some sense. And non-trivial means large and not almost everything. So the we know that this for finite simple groups of mean type, these theorems say this cannot happen. So what's the example? Take H, a subgroup of AN, which is the subgroup generated by the transpositions tau 1, 2, tau 3, 4, and so on until tau 2n minus 1 to n, and take n to be odd. Okay, so these are the transpositions. So this group is isomorphic to F2 to the m. Okay, it's m copies of z into z. And I'm going to take an element, I'm going to take A, to define A to be sigma squared, where sigma is the long cycle. Okay. Then, A together with H generates AN. Because sigma squared, n is odd, so you're going to get sigma, so you're going to get all the long cycle in it. And you have inside H, you have tau 1, 2, which is, so it's well known that the whole cycle and tau 1, 2 degenerate. So these two degenerate, but on the other hand, if you take your set A to be the approximate group. A union plus minus 1 union H union identity, so that's going to be a nice symmetric set. Then this is I don't know the constant, but there's an absolute constant C, so that it's a C approximate group. Maybe it's a 6 approximate group. Okay. So why? Because you see, this group H is almost normalized by A. It's not on the nose normalized, but almost. You see, you have these permutations, these transpositions, and applying sigma squared will shift. So in AH, A inverse, this is just going to be the group generated by 3, 4 until 2m plus 1, 1. Right? So, in fact, AH, A inverse, intersected with H, has size H over 2. So,
So with this, you see it's okay. Maybe if I did the computation, but now I already forgot. It's C equals 10, I think, is enough. So that's an approximate group. Okay. So it generates. It's an approximate group, and it's far from being everything. It's just very special. Actually, quite small subset in AN, although it's not bounded. Okay. But nevertheless, I say it's a counterexample, but not really. So it's a counterexample because it says that the situation is different from the simple groups of Lie type case. But it's not a counterexample because it's not so surprising, because for this A, we see that there is a large finite subgroup here which occupies almost all of A. So in this situation, in fact, A is controlled. A is controlled by H, the finite subgroup. Okay. So of course this does not violate the conjecture from yesterday. But it does suggest that for AN, things are probably more
controlled. You mean controlled by some constants?
Absolute constant. An absolute constant.
Because there, when if you take a sequence of linear groups like SNN,
yes, that's right.
And varying, it's prejudice.
Yes, so the constants everywhere here in those terms depend on the dimension. And they have to, essentially, because of this type of examples. So when you look at SLN and n tends to infinity, somehow you can embed this example in the value, something. And you can even make them generate the finite simple group of Lie type. Okay, so this, you'll find examples of this type in the paper by Hugo and Sapper.
But this example can be embedded into SLN of any field.
That's correct. But if you wanted to really generate SLN, you see? So,
yeah.
Yes. So you have to modify it slightly, and you can find this in their paper.
You think that a group like H plays a role of another, is H of K in the linear case, and the Lie type case?
Yes, absolutely, yes. In some sense, yes, that's correct. Yes, that these subgroups should play the role of subgroups. Okay. But what's a bit... Okay, so... Yeah, so the special feature of this example is that really you have an approximate group which still generates. So generating is probably not the right. Well, no, we're not sure about that.
Not the right thing to look at. Okay. So. So let me give you an idea of the proof. So maybe I'll. Yeah, I'll leave. Statement. So let me give you an idea of the proof. So it turned out that you can compare the two papers by us and by Hugo and Savoy, and it looks like in fact we came up with very similar arguments. So of course the details are different, but like deep inside, I think the structure of the proof is very close. So let me describe this. So Kuchowski's proof was making use of a key thing, key estimates, which is from a paper by Larsen and Pink from 1995. A preprint, actually, unpublished blueprint. And in this preprint, so they showed many very interesting things about subgroups of linear groups, finite subgroups of linear groups. Many things that, people say that it's a good alternative to the classification of finite simple groups in the case of linear groups. So it allows to classify subgroups of GLN FQ without the help of the classification of finite simple groups. But one of the key ingredients in their paper, whose main purpose, as I said, was to classify subgroups of GLN FQ, is the following inequality, so the Larson-Kink inequality. So again, G is a simple algebraic group over field, algebraically closed field K. And you look at gamma inside G of K, the finite subgroup. Then, so either gamma itself is not sufficiently Zariski dense. So this means again the same thing as before. So you contain in a proper algebraic subgroup. Gamma is contained in H of K. So H is a proper algebraic subgroup of complexity bounded in terms of G only and not on the field. Or you have the following nice property. The following non-concentration estimate. So we call it the Larson-Pink inequality. For every variety V, in G, of complexity, so of given complexity, proper subvariety. The intersection of gamma with V is small. So you have this, large subgroup. Gamma, think of K as FP to FP bar. And so in FP bar, every finite generated group is finite, so you have many finite subgroups, all the G of FQ. And inside it, you have some finite group. I don't know what it looks like. Suppose this finite group is really not degenerate, it's not contained in an algebraic subgroup. Then this theorem says that it's actually not concentrated on any variety. So in a sense, if it's not concentrated on a subgroup, it's not contained in a subgroup, algebraic subgroup. It's not even concentrated on every subvariety. So the intersection with every subvariety is at most the size of gamma to the power of the dimension of V divided by the dimension of G. And here you have, so I write it this way, because it's less or equal to a constant times this. And the constant has to depend, of course, on the complexity of the variety. But it does not depend on gamma. So, So what we did is that we have an approximate version of this theorem.
So they don't depend on the field.
They don't depend on the field. This whole one. So we have an approximate Larson-Pink inequality where, instead of taking a finite subgroup, you take A, finite K approximate subgroup, and you suppose that A is not sufficiently Zariski dense, that's the same definition, And then you have the same conclusion. A intersected with B is at most this, where you here you have to add the K to some parallel. Where C depends on the dimension of G. So let me give you, so okay. Maybe I say one sentence about why this is interesting. My plan was to give you the proof of this. The proof of the main theorem from this inequality. I'm not sure I have time, but let me just give you just an idea for the proof of this Larson theorem inequality. It's clear that such a thing can help to prove the theorem, right? Because if you know somehow that your approximate group is not concentrated on subvarieties, you can, and that's for an arbitrary subvariety, you can hope to see that this is going to be useful. So, what's the idea? Actually, the idea is quite simple. This inequality is clear. The idea is the proof is by induction on the dimension of the variety. So induction on the dimension. But you do a double induction starting from the dimension 0 and the dimension g, and you go from both ends. You work your way down, up and down. So why? Because it's clear that if the dimension of V is zero, well then the number of points in V is controlled by is less than the complexity of V. So this is obvious if the dimension is zero. You just bound this by the number of points in V, so the complexity of V. If the dimension of V is G, it's the same as V, so V is G, then it's also obvious because you bound, okay, here it's A, you bound the number of elements in the intersection by the number of elements in A itself. So when the dimension of B is 0 or G, or dimension of G, this is here. Okay. So then you keep, you're gonna go up and down, and suppose that B minus is the largest is a variety of the largest dimension for which it fails, going from zero, working your way up. And suppose V plus is a variety going from the dimension of G down. For the first dimension for which the estimate fails. So if we have the dimension of this is at most the dimension of this, okay? And you know that A intersected with V minus and A intersected with V plus are huge. They have a huge intersection on those varieties. Well, then what do I want to do? I want to build another variety for which out of those two varieties where I have a lot of intersections, I want to build another one where I have even more intersection with A, but a variety of larger dimension so that I can apply the induction. So the idea is to use the simplicity of G. And the simplicity of G can tell will tell you in rather direct way that you can find an element A in A such that V minus times multiplied by the conjugate of V plus. So this variety here, so it's a set of elements that can be written as a product of V minus times the conjugate of V plus, has dimension strictly bigger. So has dimension strictly bigger than the dimension of V plus.
Okay, because if you cannot find this, then it means essentially that you're going to have a sub-variety that is invariant on the conjugation. So you see you have this variety V, V minus, and you... So maybe V minus times V plus is the same as V plus. But if you conjugate by A, you're going to put it in another direction so that when you take the multiple, you multiply, you have a strictly bigger dimension. Okay. So this means that this variety here has few elements because of the induction hypothesis. The intersection with A has few elements. Okay. But it has few elements, but on the other hand, you know quite a few elements inside already, because you see that A in this intersection has at least has many elements. Why? Okay, so what you would like to say that this has at least elements. So this is not clear, but we would like to say this. We would like to say this. So this is clear if you see if this map. So if this map is going from take a point here, and take a point here, and sending x y to x a y. It's inverse. If this map is injective, then you're going to have many elements in here, and this will lie in here, okay? But in here you have the induction hypothesis, which tells you this is small. So that would be a contradiction. So this means this cannot happen. But then this means this map is not injective. But what does it mean? You have to look at the fibers. So if it's not injective, it means that some fiber has many elements. But the fibers themselves, they are algebraic varieties. And because of the dimensions, the dimensions are right. So the fibers, the dimensions of the fibers will be smaller than the dimension of B minus. And we can apply induction hypothesis on the fibers. Okay? And that's it. So that's basically this Larson-Pickens inequality. And okay. This is Larson-Pink spoof. Okay. So it just turns out that it's possible to adapt it to a proximal group. Okay. And so we found that this is somehow the right way to think about those things. And whenever you have a proof in group theory, just try to adapt it to proximal groups, and maybe it's going to improve. Okay, so we tried to push this in several directions, but clearly some directions completely failed. So whenever you, for instance, if you have an argument, there are many arguments in group theory that uses the divisibility properties of the cardinal of the group. You know, if the cardinal is divisible by P, there is an element of order P, and so on. For example, group cohomology is full of such things, such arguments. We tried to do some approximate group cohomology, but it failed because we can't prove the you know we cannot use we cannot adapt the classical arguments in group cohomology to approximate groups. So you have to come up with a different idea if you try to come up with a approximate group cohomology, which makes sense to some, but that's another topic. So, okay. So let me try to prove the theorem with this inequality. So, sketch of proof of the theorem modulo Larson Pink. So imagine what we are trying to do. We have an approximate subgroup A inside G of K, and
So A is a k approximate symbol. And we assume that A is sufficiently Zariski dense. So that we can apply the Larson-Fink inequality to it
whenever we want. Okay. And what are we after? What's the conclusion? We want to show that either A is small, so less than k to some power, or A is large, that is, it's almost all of the group degenerates. Okay, so that's what we want to show. So either A is small, or A is bigger than the group degenerates divided by k to the c. So the idea is to act on the variety of tori. So on G mod T. So T here is a maximal torus. So you have G mod T, and the whole proof is based on the study of the action, the left action of A on that set. G mod T. Okay. So starting granting this Larson-Fink inequality, the proof of this is really half a page. So it has two steps. So the first step is to derive some consequences of this Larson-Fink inequality. So let me derive two consequences. So the main point is that if A in A is a regular semisimple, so let's say in SLN this means that all the diagonal, all the eigenvalues are distinct. Okay, so this is a generic property. So if it was regular semisimple, then the intersection with the centralizer of A is large, and actually the size is completely controlled by the size of A to the power of the dimension of the centralizer divided by the dimension of G. And the centralizer is a torus, it's a maximal torus. So when I write this, this means up to multiplicative constants that are of the form k to some power. Okay, so why is this? So, well, you just apply last. So, okay, take an element A, look at Z of A. It's a centralizer, it's a torus, it's a maximum torus. So I can apply this inequality where I replace V by the maximum torus. So I get that the intersection of A with the maximum torus is at most number of elements in A to the power of the dimension of T divided by the dimension of G. Okay. But I want the opposite inequality. Okay, I want in both sides. So I do the opposite inequality. How? Well, I use instead of, so here, first I use T, V equals T, then I use V equals the conjugacy class of A. That's also a variety. Okay, but using the conjugacy class of A, so this was one of the inequalities I wrote down in the basic yoga in the first hour. So the action, if I look at A and I look at the conjugation action of G on itself, then this is a centralizer, this is a stabilizer of the action, and so A squared times intersected with the stabilizer times
the size of the orbit. So the size of the orbit is a to the power a, so the number of conjugates is essentially the same as a. So if you have an upper bound on this, by the Larson thing, you're going to have a lower bound on this. Okay. So this is, well, this is by the group action lemma that I stated in the first time. So this tells you you have this. Okay, I should stop. Yeah. So let me stop. Basically, just remember this. So you have the Larson thing inequality. It tells you that whenever you intersect an approximate subgroup, then whenever you have a maximal torus that intersects a approximate subgroup, then it intersects in the right amount of a to this power. Well, then this will allow you to prove a crucial lemma saying that if you have a torus T and T intersects A non-trivially, then also the conjugate of T with A will intersect A non-trivially. So the set of tori that are conjugated by that intersect A non-trivially is invariant under A, but really invariant on the nodes. So you get really a set of tori that is invariant under the whole group generated by A. And then, again, using those group action, this group action lemma, you see immediately that the orbit on G mod T on the variety of tori, if you take one torus like this and you take its A orbit, then the A orbit is almost all of the bracket A orbit, of the group generated by A orbit. So the two orbits are the same. The A orbit and the group generated by A orbits are the same. Almost the same size. But this means the group generated by A is almost the same size as the group generated as A itself. And that finishes. Yes. Right. So thanks for your attention. So maybe we should thank the organizer for this wonderful meeting.